So, fun fact, the UK Space Agency was founded in 2010.
The UK Space Agency?
Yeah.
They've been coasting off of the Royal Navy. Like, they've been coasting off colonial glory since.
I know, it's just like, that blew my mind. I'm like, get it together, y'all. 2010.
Welcome to this episode of Airspace from the Smithsonian's National Air and Space Museum with help from PRX. We're your hosts.
I'm Emily Martin.
I'm Nick Partridge.
And I'm Matt Schindel.
Today we're talking about international space exploration.
And there is more to space exploration than NASA.
How international is the International Space Station? Is it just a bunch of Americans and Russians chilling out up in space?
18 different nations have flown astronauts to the
ISS.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But the experiments being run on ISS come from 93 different countries.
Name them all.
I didn't have my Wheaties this morning. I don't think I can get through 93. Yeah.
It's pretty incredible how international space exploration has become if you look at how it began, where it was really, you know, a race between two superpower nations trying to outdo each other in space. I mean, when Apollo 11 landed on the moon in 1969, there was a plaque on the Eagle that said, we come in peace for all mankind.
Humankind.
Oh, excuse me, for all humankind. And at the time, it was hard to, you know, really read that in that way, in the context that it was done.
Speaking of Apollo, did you know that the first flag on the moon was Swiss?
Sort of.
One of the first experiments deployed on the moon was a solar wind experiment designed by a Swiss scientist and created by Switzerland. And it used a flag to collect particles from the solar wind. I'm waving my arm like a flag. It used a flag to collect particles from the solar wind. So it wasn't actually the flag of Switzerland, but it was a flag of sorts made by the Swiss. They joked about putting the actual flag of Switzerland on it, kind of to just ride the whole way on an American spaceship. And then at the very last second, oops, Switzerland, look,
we're here first. If you Google pictures of the experiment, it looks like maybe it's about 12 inches wide and it's this flag that's maybe 4 feet tall. And it looks like it's made out of, you know, those space blankets that you see like marathoners like wrapping around themselves after they finish a race.
Uh-huh. The Mylar blankets.
Is that what it is, Mylar?
Is it Mylar?
Well, it's shiny and it's silver and it's sparkly, so it looks really cool on the moon. And it's very gray, of course, because it's reflecting all the grayness around it. And there's this little tiny red splotch in the corner of the flag. And I was like, oh, that must be the Swiss flag. But it's not actually the Swiss flag. It's a big tinfoil flag that's actually an experiment from the Swiss that originated in Switzerland.
Yeah, it's kind of a jokey thing, but it was an important experiment. It flew on every Apollo mission and is the only international experiment flown to the moon during Apollo.
But these days, I mean, that really makes sense because it really did eventually open up a realm of science and a realm of exploration that pretty much the entire world is now participating in.
If you think about when the race to space was happening.
On every continent and in every land, the story of Sputnik 1 dominated the front pages.
The United States space program, bruised and battered in competition with the Soviet Union, took a significant and highly gratifying step forward today. The United States, on its first try, sent a man into space and recovered him safely.
It didn't take very long before you had these two superpowers, U.S. and Russia, working together. And I think most notably, as we were talking about before, the International Space Station. I mean, the Russians launched the very first piece of the International Space Station in 1998. And a couple weeks later, the U.S. launched a second piece of the space station with a crewed mission to go Lego brick the two pieces together and actually create what is now, I don't know how many pieces are part of the International Space Station, but
minimum 93, right?
Well, maybe. I don't know. Do you count the inflatable hab that they put up there recently?
So, all right. I was joking. There are certainly more than 93 moving pieces.
So space exploration has become international, and that's not just the International Space Station, but it's also planetary science and studying the solar system, right? I mean, it's easy for us as Americans to just look at NASA and look at what NASA is doing and think that this is what's happening in space. But in fact, other countries are doing quite a lot and sending things out, although usually on either a different scale or with different types of goals in mind.
With some of these larger space agencies, they have the flexibility to do things like space research in terms of planetary science research as well as human exploration research. But there's a lot of other countries that we'd never think about as having space agencies, and it's a little bit more out of necessity.
So what are some other countries with space programs?
Israel, Sri Lanka, Hungary.
The UK and France each have their own space program, even though they're also part of ESA, the European Space Agency.
Bangladesh, Lithuania.
Also, Turkey has a space program.
Mongolia has a space agency, which
really
kind of blew my mind. And the purpose of that space agency specifically is to put satellites up into orbit so that they can do real-time remote sensing and mitigating natural hazards of their region.
And that can include looking out for storms, tracking weather patterns, and also studying the way that land is used and mapping out the usable land in a territory.
Simply taking care of some national interest stuff. So it's not just the U.S. and Europe.
How many spaceports are there? How many countries have spaceports?
I don't actually know the answer to that. I know Israel is the smallest country with a spaceport and launch capabilities.
A spaceport meaning a location where a rocket could be launched into space.
Right. While the U.S. has spaceports that are capable of launching humans into space because, you know, we did put people on the moon and we're still the only ones who have accomplished that feat, we don't have a rocket anymore that's capable of launching humans into space, which is why we go to Kazakhstan.
Yeah. The vast majority of space missions don't involve sending people into orbit. ESA, the European Space Agency, has had a lot of really high-profile solar system missions over the last few years.
Yeah, so the Cassini-Huygens mission was a joint ESA and NASA mission to Saturn. ESA also sent an orbiter to Mars.
And then there was the Rosetta mission to a comet.
Yeah, Rosetta was really spectacular. And if you ever saw the comics,
yeah,
the sort of like anthropomorphized version of Rosetta and its little tiny Philae lander. They gave it a little backpack. And the Philae lander was really spectacular because Rosetta, the spacecraft itself, was going into orbit around this comet named 67P. And I said 67P because the first two words, can you say it, Matt?
No.
Look it up. It's a lot of letters. It's a lot of consonants, and I don't want to say it. And it was when it landed on the surface, it was supposed to deploy these harpoons to, like, latch into the surface because the gravity on 67P is really small. Well, didn't totally work the way they had planned, so Philae kind of bounced off the surface. And it managed to land back on the surface, which was really impressive, but it meant for a while they didn't actually know where the Philae lander was. And it landed in this shadow, so it didn't end up having as much power as it had hoped because it was solar powered.
It was in a small crevice, wasn't it?
Something like that. So they did end up finding it a while later, but that was a wildly successful mission, and you should look up some of the photos from that mission because they're some of the most alien terrains you'll ever see, and that's saying something since I look at weird stuff in the outer solar system.
Always take a look, by the way, at the scale in the bottom corner of those photos because, man, what you're looking at is huge. The scenes from that comet, what look like rocks you could pick up in your hand, are 30 feet across. They're in meters, though, so it's hard for the Americans to do math.
Sure. So we mentioned ESA sent orbiters to Mars. The Indian Space Research Organization has also been to the Red Planet. They have a Mars orbiter, which has been collecting data since 2014. They've also been to the moon, and I believe they're getting ready to go again, if they haven't already, back to the moon.
Robotically, in all
robotically,
these cases.
Yes, none of these are human exploration missions. But the Japanese Space Agency has done some really spectacular sample return missions.
Yeah, starting in 2003, they sent their first robotic mission to an asteroid called Itokawa.
It launched in 2003. It came back in 2010. So these are really long-duration missions. But one of the things that I think is most impressive is not just the engineering feat, the technological feat to make these sample returns happen, but they have opened up these samples to the community in the same way that here at the Smithsonian, if you're a scientist and you need to work on some meteorites, you can write into the meteorite curator. And they don't just hand them out to everybody. You have to justify why you need these samples, and there's a panel that decides whether or not they're going to distribute those samples to you. But they're not just keeping those for themselves, they're keeping it for everybody.
The Japanese Space Agency has launched two missions to asteroids. The first one, Hayabusa, brought back 1,500 samples from its asteroid, and the second, Hayabusa 2, just got to its asteroid. But Hayabusa 1 brought back tiny, tiny little samples.
Do you know what the total weight is?
It's tiny.
It's something like grams, right?
Yeah, yeah, because these are small, small particles. But you know what one of the coolest things is about these particles?
Tell me what the coolest thing is about these particles, Matt.
If you look at them under a microscope, really close up, what you see is that they have tiny, tiny craters in them.
Micrometeorites, if you will.
Yes, so these little particles have been struck by micrometeorites.
Nanometeorites.
Yes.
Do you think they're so small that they could be nanometeorites?
Is that a term yet?
I don't know.
It just teaches you that there are all these tiny little things whizzing about in the asteroid belt, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And right now, Hayabusa 2 is out there. Pictures are coming back regularly. They just sent a close-up of the surface of the asteroid. The images show that there are huge boulders on the surface.
So the samples from Hayabusa will go to scientists and labs all over the world. Is it safe to say that most space missions are international in some way?
Right. So you can say Curiosity is an American rover. You could say that the Indian Space Research Organization's mission to the moon was an Indian mission, but there were NASA instruments on that mission too, in the same way that there's ESA instruments on NASA missions. It's just you can't really just put that one flag or that one stamp on each one of these missions, because even if it's under the umbrella of the space agency of a particular nation, they've all helped each other. I mean, they've all worked together, and the scientific community is international. You can't just say, well, I work with this person over in Italy, but I'm not going to ask the expert in this thing to not help out with this mission, because ultimately you want it to be a success. And that means you have to pull in the people who can do the work, who are the best of the best of the best, as Rip Torn would say.
You know, there's no denying that even today, one of the main things that a country gets out of having a space program or having a successful mission is a certain amount of international prestige. It sort of allows you entry into an international club of spacefaring nations.
It's really the same as other clubs. The bar just has, like, the prices are increased. It's much more expensive.
I think you get a special, like, black credit card with stars on it.
Amex Black with Starfield.
It's the Diners Club.
No, it's the Discovery card, Matt.
That's it for this mini episode of Airspace.
Airspace is produced by Katie Moyer, Lizzie Peabody, and Jocelyn Frank.
Mixed by Tarek Fuda. Special thanks to Jason Orfanon, John Barth, and Genevieve Sponsler.
Check us out on Twitter at Air and Space.
We'll be back at the beginning of next month. Airspace is supported by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation, enhancing public understanding of science, technology, and economic performance. More information at sloan.org.
If we've been up there for about 20 years, living in the space station, I mean, do you remember what your technology was like 20 years ago? Do you remember what your life was like 20 years ago?
The International Space Station actually runs entirely on Tamagotchi technology. They plug all of the main computers into Tamagotchi keychains.